This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
We have such a wide range of news to talk about, in addition to some Emmy shows that we did not get to last week that we heard from you guys about. Duly noted, we love to continue hearing from you. Email littlegoldman@vf.com. So we'll talk about some of the shows that we didn't get to because there really is just so much television. But there's news about the Oscars. There's news about Cannes. There's Barbie posters. Hopefully by the time you're hearing this, the enthusiasm for the Barbie posters is as intense as it is on Tuesday morning when we're recording this. Well, let's start with the changes at the Academy. There are some rumors about what kind of changes they might implement, and then there are some actual announcements. And Rebecca, you kind of captured the lay of the land for us this week. What's real, what's rumored, and what matters?
Well, they really did establish a new branch, which was their first sort of active business post-Oscars. Basically, in this time of year, we expect to hear from the Academy about some changes for the coming year. So they just created the production and technology branch, which is basically kind of their way of collecting all the hodgepodge members at large under one group, finally. So it's everyone from like script supervisors and colorists to more jobs that are really steeped in sort of the technology and creative services. And they're all in one group now, which is the first time they've created a branch in years, I think since 2013. So that's a notable move. It means there'll be a new governor from that branch, which they'll have to elect. And it also, you know, there's been a lot of discussion for years about a stunt category at the Oscars. Mm-hmm. And this did make me wonder if that might be something they're seriously considering, because this group also would include stunt coordinators. And so that's just something I was wondering about. I have no reporting on that, but I am curious, you know, if that is something they would seriously consider.
Although wasn't the casting director's branch the last one that they introduced, and we're still no closer to a casting Oscar?
We even had a casting director president, and there's still no casting director Oscar. So I think those are huge uphill battles. You're totally right. But then, yeah. I mean, maybe we should get a little bit into the rumors that are happening, because I do think we're going to see more changes coming after they have a meeting in late April.
Well, maybe we should talk. So before we get to the newest rumor, you reminded me in your write-up that the social media changes is the thing that they have said that they will tackle and they haven't announced yet in the wake of the two Leslie to-do. And we still don't really know exactly how far they're going to go with that.
Yeah, I would wonder if anyone could come up with a good solution to that problem, because the rules can either be too vague or too specific, and, you know, loopholes are going to exist no matter what. So I'm really curious to see what they do. I think there may be more sort of clear rules about what you can and can't express on social media as a member of the Academy. But I think there's a lot of determination to make campaigning rules clearer. Good luck to them, because that is a really hard task.
They're going to set up all these rules for Twitter, and then Twitter's going to explode, and then we have to go back to the drawing board. I mean, Richard, you're as online as the rest of us. Like, do you have any kind of desire for what they would do here?
I mean, I think it would be nice if there was some kind of way. I don't know what would be in the Academy's power to do so, to level the financial playing field somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the thing about To Leslie getting dinged for this campaigning was that this was free, you know. Mm-hmm. They weren't spending a bundle on ads on the Sunset Strip or whatever, you know, more traditional campaigning would allow for. And they got in trouble for that. you know, which kind of feels unfair for a small movie using the resources in front of them, which happen to be a lot of well-connected celebrity friends. You know, that feels like, you know, if the Academy doesn't want just like, I mean, it's kind of analogous to our politics, like the most funded campaigns to be the ones that are successful, they'll have to kind of figure that out. But I also think that social media, A, we're dealing with people who are not necessarily age-wise natively online, you know? So there might be some lack of understanding there partially, and also who may just be kind of sniffy about it in general. And like, because it's not traditional, they're looking down on it. And I think as much as it might seem kind of suspicious that people are copying and pasting the same copy to get Andrea Riseborough a nomination, like, is that any more or less underhanded than, you know, honor the man, honor the film, you know?
Do you think if they hadn't copied and pasted, anyone would have ever noticed? Like, would this have gone completely under the radar?
I mean, I think there was a strange and noticeable surge of support for a movie that most people had never heard of, you know? But yes, it could have seemed a bit more organic, let's say, had people used different language, and maybe if it didn't all come out within 3 days. But they, but that was the window that they had, and they, you know, released the Kraken that is Frances Fisher, and and it worked. You know, I mean, it ended up kind of blowing back in everyone's face, and which is too bad. But yeah, I mean, I think obviously the campaigning has gotten insane. I don't want to say that it's all bad, because obviously we here at VF, like, we are part of that. We benefit from it as well. But yeah, something to kind of level the playing field, and also just have a broader understanding of like the realities of social media and that stuff. Because if you start making hard and fast rules, there's always a but. There's always, you know, it's very if then. Well, if we can't do this, then can we do that? And it gets really tricky, as you were saying, Rebecca.
Yeah, it's just, I just don't know how you level the playing field for both financial and influence. You know, it's like, of course, the Academy's messaging is like, we want this to be about the films. But it's like, this is Hollywood. I just, it's hard to sort of put rules on both those categories that will work. I'm so curious to see how they approach it.
And I think social media is in some ways the lifeblood of the Oscars continuing to be relevant. You know, A24 can leverage social media like nobody else. That was a huge part of Everything Everywhere All at Once's, you know, continued campaign. And I think there had been this idea that A24 didn't spend any traditional money, which isn't really true, but they certainly use social media in a more savvy way than a lot of these other competitors. And for the Academy to lock down social media to an extent that they're kind of afraid to try to do that, then you're going to have like less eyeballs on the Oscars in general, which is what they don't want.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. And I think also with the To Leslie thing, like, it was a humbler campaign than some, which were having lavish parties at film festivals months before nominations, you know, all that stuff. But you look at something like Till, which, you know, probably budget-wise was about the same. It was probably more expensive than To Leslie, but, you know, it was smaller in profile. It didn't have a huge star at the center, although a great performance, and yet didn't really work for that. I mean, that movie didn't get the kind of thing because it wasn't quite as well connected, and I think that obviously has to do a lot with, like, there are just fewer powerful Black people in Hollywood because of decades of prejudice. And, you know, so even though To Leslie was tiny and was doing it sort of grassroots, they had a leg up on another deserving film. And so is there any way to make this totally fair? I don't know at this point, at least not in the Academy's power. But it's good that they're thinking about it, at least. I hope they come up with the right, you know, course forward.
Yeah.
I do feel like the Oscar, this new leadership has made some really good decisions. I feel like overall the choices they made for the Oscars went over really well after quite a few years of turmoil. So I'm hopeful that they'll find something that feels fair.
Yeah, it might be vague in the same way that this current social media rules are vague, because social media changes so fast, and you set a hard and fast rule and then you have to reverse back. But, you know, maybe a little bit more helpful than the vague rules we have now. I mean, the money question comes up with the rumor that came up last week, as reported in Puck by Matt Bellany, that the Oscars might require a more robust theatrical release in the future to qualify for Best Picture. Rebecca, you want to explain that one a little bit more?
Yeah. You know, the rumor is that they're considering the idea of expanding the theatrical requirement. Right now, films are required to play theatrically for 1 week in one of six major markets, LA, New York, Chicago, Miami, Atlanta, or the Bay Area. And so this would require them to play around 15 of the top 50 markets in the U.S., so a much, much bigger theatrical play, which obviously would make movie theater owners super happy. And I would assume, make distributors a little stressed out, specifically the streamers, because, you know, obviously a lot of them have just been doing that sort of 1 week requirement to qualify. So it's an interesting idea. I mean, from what I've heard, this is very, very early and has to still obviously be approved by the board and a little far away from being real. But, you know, it's interesting to see that they're thinking about this, and it would be such a way to support movie theaters, which obviously have been feeling the struggle.
And it's a good time for it, too. You know, Everything Everywhere wins Best Picture off of a really strong theatrical run. I think it made like $500,000 in theaters after it won Best Picture when it had been, you know, available until a year into its theatrical release. And Top Gun and Avatar, obviously, in there, too. Like, I think the Oscars and box office relationship is more intuitive than it has been for the last couple of years. It feels like a good timing if they're going to pull something like this off.
Yeah, I mean, expanding those qualification rules, though, I mean, there are so many films, smaller films, usually a lot of times international films that will play a week in LA or New York and then come out like with a proper theatrical release months and months later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that would kind of screw that whole model up, because if you're playing in 15 or however many, you know, cities, that's a full release in some ways. Yeah. You know, are you going to take it away and then put it out again in April? Like, you know, that model has been built very carefully over a long time, the sort of platforming kind of thing, usually with a qualification embedded in there. But yeah, I mean, Netflix kind of bought a theater in New York for this reason. I mean, I know they had other reasons too, but
now,
like,
they have to buy a theater in Orlando and in San Diego. Yeah.
Which, like, hey, if it makes people open movie theaters, I'm all for that. When we've had thousands of movie theaters close across the country in the past 2 years. I mean, I think as a purist, I'm like, good. These movies should be theatrical films that are considered, and more people in more cities should have access to them, you know, when we in New York or LA do. But yeah, for like a Sony Pictures Classics or, mm-hmm. you know, Kino Lorber, these smaller distributors who, you know, will do a gentle release for Petit Maman in December in New York City and then put that movie out much later. I wonder how that will really shake up that whole structure that they've built.
Franklin Leonard also had a really smart thread that made me think about this in a different way about, you know, if you're a filmmaker, a newcomer, or probably a filmmaker of color, and your film gets bought at Sundance or wherever by a streamer or a I don't know, one of these like Hulu, Disney releasers, and you're negotiating your release contract, you don't have the power of a Ryan Johnson or someone to be like, I need a theatrical release, you know? Mm-hmm. And the great thing about the streamers is they have bought and distributed movies that, you know, traditional distributors maybe thought were too risky to do a theatrical release, and given especially up and coming filmmakers that opportunity. And so now those films would not qualify, or you'd have to negotiate this sort of really intense theatrical release just to get a chance. And yeah, I don't know if it makes the system more fair or less so. So it's I don't know. I don't know if that one's going to work or just make a certain group very happy and everyone else really frustrated.
It would require a lot of changes. And I don't know that these economics are ever going to be publicly available, but I'd love to know how much it costs to run in 15 markets for a theatrical 1 week release, however, whatever qualifies, versus spending on FYC ads or all the other things that you would do to boost your smaller movie. Like, maybe that is, like, those economics just shift. That money exists. It just has to be put somewhere else. But it does make you wonder about, like, the Two Leslies of the world. I'm sure Two Leslie never played in 15 markets in its theatrical release. That money's got to come from somewhere if we want to have the broader range of voices in the Oscar race, which is what the Academy has certainly said that they want.
There's also the matter of those smaller movies I mentioned, like, do on occasion get to say when they do a proper release in the spring or late winter of the year following their technical release date, is like, they can be like named the best movie of the year by all these people and given this critics prize and that nomination. And because they have the time to have amassed those accolades, if they now have to do a bigger release before any of that can happen, how does that affect their marketing? I mean, maybe it's bad for them in that way.
Yeah. Although I'd be interested to hear from listeners too, because I think this is a source of frustration for people who aren't, you know, don't have access to film festivals or screenings the way that we do often, where you hear about Petite Maman opening somewhere for a week in December and then wait a year for it to come out. It's kind of maddening. So like maybe this makes it so that by the time the Oscars happen, more people have had a chance to actually see these movies. I imagine that's part of the logic.
Yeah, maybe it all just comes back to ratings. They're just like, if we can figure out a way to ensure that more people have seen these things, then people will watch the broadcast.
Yeah. I mean, Rick, as you said, this is not an official decision. It seems like if this does happen at all, it might be take a different shape than what we're discussing right now. So I guess this is the time to make your comments known. Like the Academy's on Twitter. Go tweet at them and tell them what you want to see happen, because it's a moving target right now.
I feel like we're going to see some other surprise changes this year.
Ooh, you want to place any bets?
No, I don't know. But I just feel like I think they're really focused on making some changes. So I think the next few months will be very interesting.
Just to kind of repeat ourselves a little bit, I'm encouraged by the idea of focusing on theatrical releases more. You know, I was looking at the box office from this past weekend where 1001, I interviewed Teyana Taylor on the show last week. It's a small movie. It was at, you know, big Sundance winner, but a very small scale thing. You know, they opened it, Focus Features opened it on 926 screens and it made $1.7 million. Like, I think putting faith behind a small movie like that can pay off in a lot of ways. So the box office is coming back. People are going back to theaters. And I like that the Academy is willing to push even further in that direction.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, to talk about further news, and Richard and Rebecca, I'm just going to hold back my envy because we're going to talk about Cannes, where you two are going and I am not. But there's been some actual confirmation of what will be at Cannes in addition to a whole bunch of rumors. Richard, what are you going to be doing when you sit down to watch Indiana Jones 5 on the Croisette?
Well, maybe I'll be in a tuxedo because I'll be at the premiere. Who knows? You know, are they going to do a big fancy party for the movie? Yeah, that's a fun one. You know, Cannes likes to have, you know, a Mad Max or a Top Gun Maverick or something splashy commercial. Elvis too last year, although that ended up being, both of those ended up being awards movies as well. So the Indiana Jones one is a little surprising just because it's not Spielberg directing it, you know. It's James Mangold, I believe, right? And and who is, you know, himself, like, he had Ford vs. Ferrari a couple years ago. Like, he's no stranger to sort of festivals and awards and all that stuff. But yeah, a fifth movie in a series, that's sort of interesting. Although Mad Max, I guess, was the fourth.
Shrek, some number of Shreks.
Shreks 1 and 2 both played in competition, Katie.
Did they really?
Yes.
Oh my God. I didn't realize that.
Isn't that strange? Moulin Rouge, Shrek, the first Shrek, and Mulholland Drive were all at the same Cannes.
This feels like a Richard bit that I'm just...
That's true. That's real.
Well,
that's
no, we're going to make you do Cannes recaps from 20 years ago like we do of the Oscars.
Yeah. It is fascinating to look at the sort of random movies that have played there. But yeah, another thing about that, you get celebrities on the carpet, which they love, and the photographers love, and the media outlets love, and et cetera. So, and to that end, you also have Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, which... A year ago, we thought it was coming out in 2022, and then they said, no, we're holding it till 2023, and kind of with that news was at Cannes. Like, we kind of knew about that.
Did they actually say that, or did we all just assume it? It's funny how long we have assumed it would be at Cannes.
I think there was one piece, either in THR, Variety, or somewhere like that, that said it's likely or possible, and everyone just took that as gospel fact. And luckily, it's been confirmed.
Yeah, it's nice. Yeah, I mean, we talked about that a lot in our year ahead predictions episode this year and last year. So there's been a lot discussed, but I'm just glad that we'll know soon. Like, is this going to be Lily Gladstone's year? Is Jesse Plemons going to be a best actor, best supporting actor? Like, there's such a big cast, and I read the book, but there's so many different ways you can tell that story. I'm just, even though I won't get to see it there, I'm glad some of those mysteries will be solved.
Do we know how long Killers of the Flower Moon is? Is this the one that's rumored to be insanely long?
Yes. I thought that was Beau Is Afraid that we had to get corrected.
Well, I had heard it was 4 hours.
It's we'll not, get it's only to that in a minute, too.
It's only three. But yeah, I had seen something that the movie that Cannes wanted them to cut Killers of the Flower Moon or edit it because it was too long and they couldn't slot it in enough, like in a schedule. And it's like, that's not really how Cannes operates. It's not like Toronto where they're just, right. You know, they're going to let, I would assume, Scorsese premiere his movie as he's made it, you know?
Yeah.
And Winter Sleep, which was the Palme d'Or winner back in 2014, I think, that was, I think, 2 minutes shorter than Killers of the Flower Moon's current reported runtime. So right. I don't think that they're going to cut the movie.
Yeah, Apple announced that and then also released a still from Napoleon and confirmed that it's coming out in the fall. It didn't come with any festival rumors. I guess it could. I don't think it'll be at Cannes. That would be weird for them to do both of them at the same time. But it was a nice show of strength from Apple, who kind of, you know, won Best Picture, more or less had a year off last year, although they did get the Causeway nomination for Brian Tyree Henry. They got a strong hand this year and they seem to know it.
Yeah. And most importantly, we should mention, we're having a party, right? Are we allowed to say that?
I don't know.
I think so. Okay. It's been out there.
Unfortunately, if you're listening to this, it doesn't mean you're invited. We have to.
Richard and I hope we're invited.
We'll do a Hunger Games style contest to see who gets in.
If Leonardo DiCaprio's in Cannes, presumably he would come to the party, which.
Well.
That's a big deal, right?
Yeah. I'll be editing one of your party reports at 5 a.m. my time. So everyone envy me and my role in this party.
I feel like they're the same day, the premiere and party. I don't know. This is something we'll have to figure out.
Well, was last year COVID affected at Cannes, or was it more or less back to normal, or is this really the first normal Cannes?
Last year was pretty normal.
It was pretty normal, and so much is outside there. I mean, in the theaters, I remember I was still wearing a mask, as I still do now. But and so much of the events are and parties and stuff are outside that it felt okay.
Yeah, no, you don't have to go back to Cannes in July anymore, Richard. Those days are behind us.
Oh, thank God. I don't know if I could do it, humidity-wise.
I mentioned Beau Is Afraid earlier as the rumored long movie, which is not out yet, but has been kind of poking its head out. It had a big screening at the Alamo Drafthouse in New York over the weekend. Is that where you saw it, Richard, or did you catch it elsewhere?
Elsewhere, but that screening, they did, I think, a couple at Alamos across the country, possibly. And it was on Saturday, April 1st. So it was billed as a Midsummer director's cut with in New York Ari Aster presenting it. And then it was, JK, we're showing you the whole thing of Beau Is Afraid. Because there was going to be like an extended trailer for Beau Is Afraid and then Midsummer. And instead it was the whole of Beau.
That's like an old school Comic-Con bait and switch. I like it.
It's A24. They're so smart. That's, you know, because that's all I saw on Twitter was all these people being like, oh, it's an April Fool's joke. And then everyone's talking about it. It's such a smart marketing move. They really impress me time after time.
And it's nice when an April Fool's joke is like beneficial to the person being tricked, you know, like it's not to their detriment at all. But yeah, I mean, that said, Beau Is Afraid, you know, it's the review embargo has not lifted, but social sentiment is out there. So I think I can vaguely say like Beau Is Afraid is a very different movie from Midsommar or Hereditary, Aster's previous two films. It moves slightly out of the horror genre. It's more of a fantastical comedy, drama, Freudian thing you know, maybe there were some people in that audience who were like, I really just wanted to watch Midsommar. But, you know, to see a movie a few weeks before it comes out, like, that's exciting. And so, yeah, people seemed mostly on Twitter to be very effusive about it.
Also, like, it really just proves that he's an auteur, you know what I mean? That he has these fans that are like, okay, it's not the movie I thought it was, but it's still Ari Aster, so I don't care. I will watch this movie, you know? So, and he's so young to, like, have that sort of fan base. It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to have engendered that after just three movies. I mean, really only after two, because most people haven't seen Beau yet. So yeah, he's He's definitely, like, after seeing Midsommar, I was like, that guy is, like, the next Paul Thomas Anderson or something. Like, and this, Beau Is Afraid, does move him more towards in that direction. So it's
I've
interesting.
I've heard Charlie Kaufman's name evoked a few times about Beau Is Afraid.
Yeah, it's very, there's a very synecdoche New York quality to it. Also, some Anna Melissa is in there. Mm-hmm. Some of the one with Jesse Buckley, the title of which I can never properly remember.
I'm thinking of Ending Things.
I'm Thinking of Ending Things, thank you. Yeah, their influences are definitely there, but it also, at the same time, feels like a singular thing from a new up-and-coming director.
Richard, do you see an awards path for this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Joaquin Phoenix is certainly doing a lot in it. It's a very, you know, it's a big performance in some ways and sort of restrained in others. But yeah, I mean, it's a really weird movie. So I'd be curious to see how they marketed it in the awards sense. I mean, I know Everything Everywhere was weird too, but that movie has a sentiment to it, an uplift to it by the end that Beau, I think, is a darker affair.
We don't really go to Ari Aster for uplift, at least not at this point in his career.
Not yet, no. But for me, the really interesting narrative could be Patti LuPone, who plays Beau's mother in the film. And when she's on screen, she reminds you why she's Patti fucking LuPone. And also reminds you that, like, man, just she's gotten very few film roles. She's been on she was on TV, you know, in Life Goes On years ago and pops up in things here and there. But this is like a meaty, exciting theatrical role for her in a you know, major director's film, and that's pretty exciting.
Oh man, that would be such a fun Oscar campaign. Holy moly.
I would look out for her at New York Film Critics Circle, but is what I'll say. Based on the tweets I saw.
You're gonna be whipping votes for her in the cloakroom. I mean, between that and then the Napoleon announcement and then the Joker set photos, Joaquin Phoenix is just all over the place right now. It's, you know, every time he's on an awards campaign, he seems so completely miserable. And you're like, will he ever come back again? And then he keeps making fascinating movies. So welcome back, Joaquin. You got to do it all over again.
Despite the family connections, obviously, to his brother River, like, Joaquin Phoenix is a very unlikely kind of movie star.
Yeah.
And yet he does it because he had, I mean, kind of similar to Ari Aster, like, there are people who are like, I'm on board for any Joaquin Phoenix movie. You know, I'm not necessarily one of those people, but, like, he definitely has an ardent fan base that can put him in something like this and something like Joker, and people are equally happy.
I am always interested in what he's going to do. Like, even when, like, it's something like Joker, which is not entirely my speed, like, he has never been boring, really, that I can think of. I don't know. I've never saw some of those, like, early 2000s post-Gladiator movies, so maybe somewhere in there. But these days, he's really captivating. Okay, one more news thing before we jump into some movies that are coming out now. Barbie posters. There's so many of them. I picked a favorite, which is Midge, Emerald Fennell, because she's pregnant for some reason, and I don't know why, and I'm intrigued. Who else wants to pick a favorite Barbie poster and or explain how hyped we are for Barbie at this point?
I mean, it was fun to see that Dua Lipa has, I think, a couple new songs that are going to be in the film.
Is she a mermaid?
She's a mermaid.
One?
Yeah.
Of course.
And the Hari Neff one was cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just makes you really realize this cast, like, how interesting it is, And I don't know. I can't remember the last time that a movie had this much, like, social media thirst every time something, they release the smallest thing.
Like, pre-release thirst.
Yes. Yeah.
And, like, in our, you know, there's the superhero movie version, you know, like, I'm sure Avengers Endgame had it. But, like, for our corner, you know, not just Oscar-y, but, like, people who are a little burned out on franchises and spectacle movies, to be this hyped for Barbie feels special.
I do wonder, and I'm not an expert in any of these things, but, like, the movie's out in July, it's early April, and this campaign has already been going for months at this point. Like, the teaser that's the 2001 ripoff, or, I mean, homage, it's not a ripoff, they know what they're doing, has been playing in theaters for months. I wonder if they might be risking fatigue before the movie even comes out, and also, like, they're setting up a lot of expectations. And can any movie possibly meet that? There was a screening of it where I saw some tweets about it, like a month ago, maybe, where people were, like, really effusive about it. But again, can we trust those early views? I don't know. But and that movie was also rumored at one point to maybe be at Cannes. I don't think that's going to happen. But who knows?
Is Oppenheimer still on the Cannes rumor? It seems unlikely for that and Indiana Jones to both be there. But
yeah, I think now that Jones has been announced and Flower Moon, I think... Yeah, it seems unlikely there'd be another big film out of competition.
Yeah. I mean, the Oppenheimer Barbie like duo, I'm thrilled by it. I'm so glad they haven't moved release dates. I'm so glad that that is the weekend we get to anticipate. I don't know if I will get to see them back to back, but I'm just like operating as if I will. I hope Oppenheimer has its own string of character posters after this. I mean, they just keep volleying back and forth all summer.
And Dua Lipa has recorded new songs for Oppenheimer. Oh,
yeah,
well.
Of course. Yeah, she plays the bomb. Oppenheimer, right?
Yeah.
Okay, to talk about movies in theaters right now, I mentioned 1001, and you can listen to the Teyana Taylor interview from last week if you happen to see that. But there's some even larger releases coming this week. Super Mario's on the horizon. I assume it will make $1 trillion because there's been nothing for kids for months. But Richard, you and I have both seen Air, which is out, I think now, I think it's a Wednesday release. So as you hear this, it is in theaters. Coming right at the end of March Madness. It's a basketball movie, and a basketball movie that you and I both liked, which is not, you know, we're not necessarily the target audience here.
It's a shoe movie, Katie.
Oh, we're obviously the target audience for shoe movies.
I mean, Affleck, in that great Hollywood Reporter interview that our former colleague Rebecca Keegan did, he said, look, I went to Michael Jordan. I told him, I'm not making a movie about you, but I'm not going to make the movie I want to make unless I have your blessing. And he was given that blessing. And so the movie is not about Michael Jordan. He appears in it very briefly, and you kind of just see him from behind. It's about his parents, played by Viola Davis and her real-life husband, Julius Tenen, and about these shoe guys. Matt Damon plays a marketing executive who specializes in scouting basketball talent. Ben Affleck is Phil Knight, the, I guess, now former CEO of Nike. So it's a process movie. It's a business movie. And I found it entertaining. I don't know if it moved me because it was, again, just about sneakers and the making of money. But it's well done. It's kind of shaggy and low to the ground. And I think that's a good sweet spot for Affleck and Damon to be in as they launch their artist equity production company.
It surprised me how much it was about the themes of artist equity, which I knew about from reading that Rebecca Keegan article, where basically they started a production company where, the top cast and the cinematographer and various other crew member have equity stake in the movie, right? Like it's a kind of a everyone shares alike deal.
I think so. I think Affleck said that depending on how the movie does in theaters, like the cinematographer will be the highest paid cinematographer of the year or something like that. There was some pithy quote about that.
And it's an interesting new model. And then that becomes part of the plot of the movie. And, you know, I guess spoilers for history, but part of it is that Michael Jordan got a stake in the sales of Air Jordans, there's one of the title cards at the end reveals. Do you remember how much passive income he makes from Air Jordans every year, Richard? Do you remember this number?
I remember it's more than I make in a year.
it's $400 million a year.
Oh, my God.
It's just a little bit less.
I know. You'll get there one of these days, Richard. It's slightly mind-boggling. And, you know, that's a result of the negotiation of his mother, played by Viola Davis. And Ben Affleck, again, in that amazing piece, which everyone should read, talked about how Michael Jordan basically said, I want Viola Davis to play my mom. And he was like, no, like, she's not going to show up for this role. And then I guess they rewrote the script to make her a bigger part. And she's so good in it in a way that she's great in everything, but like the role of Michael Jordan's mom, you can't really prepare yourself for how significant it becomes in the story.
She's really good in it. It's a slightly different tone and tempo than we've seen her in. You know, the movie's lighter. She tends to do a lot of heavier fare, so that's kind of fun. I mean, the stakes are serious for her and her family, the character, but you know, it's not big monologues and whatnot. And also, you know, between this and in the upcoming Nicole Hollow Center film where David Cross and Amber Tamblyn play a married couple and here Viola Davis and Julius Tenen are, I'm like, I think I really like right now actual real life couples playing couples in movies. It's just there's such an easy, obvious chemistry, you know.
He's wonderful in it, too.
He is in
a much more like less complex character as presented on screen. But he really lights up the screen when he's there.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, everyone's good. You know, Matthew, I think Mayer is how you say his last name. He's like a real staple of the New York theater scene. He plays the guy who designed the Air Jordan. He's really good. Chris Messina is sort of a slimy agent, is good.
He's really funny. He gets the best laughs, I think.
Yeah. It's just a well-populated movie. And, you know, I think I was supposed to maybe feel a bit more inspired or something at the end than I did. But it's very entertaining. And maybe that's the best we can hope for in early April.
It definitely got me, and it's the way, and I don't want to I think the impact of it is better if you don't know too much about it. But the way that it uses footage of real Michael Jordan, and not just in the, like, it has the title card at the end where it tells you where everyone turned out. It says, Michael Jordan became the greatest basketball player of all time. You're like, oh, I wouldn't have figured that out from watching this movie.
Today but, we call them computers.
Today we call them Air Jordans. It goes beyond that. And the way that it uses performances in the movie and then footage of Michael Jordan and where his life went after this moment really got me. And Jason Bateman's got a great monologue about, like, both shoes being manufactured in Korea and taking his daughter to the park on Sundays that, like, I didn't figure out how it all fit together, but it still got to me. I think even if you're, like, lightly sports inclined, this movie will work for you. I would really recommend it to just about anybody.
I got teary at the nice music while they played footage of Michael Jordan. Because it was just like, wow, like, this is the beginning of this, like, phenomenal thing that you know, this person did over the years. And
because he's a complicated figure, you know, like, his sports legacy is kind of unrivaled. But, you know, he's had a complicated life and it doesn't shy away from that either. But it has a very light touch because it's not a movie about him, as Ben Affleck said. That really impressed me. I'm just happy to see Ben Affleck back. Like, have him and J-Lo make a movie next. It sounds like what you're asking for, Richard.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Another one.
And maybe not just some junky romantic comedy. Like, let's learn the lessons of Hustlers and then put J-Lo in something worthy of her abilities. And she and Affleck can vibe together. Hopefully it wouldn't destroy the relationship like the last one did. Although I don't think Geely is to blame for their breakup all those years ago, nor is Jersey Girl. But he's a good, solid, old-fashioned kind of Hollywood director. And he's not trying to do a ton of stuff and, you know, be fancy with the camera or anything like that. I mean, the movie looks nice, but yeah, it's just very sturdy and workmanlike, which I guess fits the tone of the movie.
Totally. Yeah, Rebecca, you kind of mentioned it as insurance in their Oscar predictions episode. And it's hard to see the path for how it hangs in there, but I wouldn't mind it. You know, I think if it opens now, it goes quiet for a while. And then in the fall, we start being like, you know, what was great was Air. I can absolutely see that happening.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you thought about its potential for that. But, you know, I think a lot of that is also it's an Amazon release. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they haven't had the easiest path with Oscars yet. So that's a little bit of an additional challenge for it. But you guys have sold me on it. I'm actually seeing it tonight. So now my expectations are super high. Thanks a lot.
Oh, no.
Katie, we shouldn't have released those character posters and sent them only to Rebecca.
For four different designs of the shoe, each got their own poster.
Know that fizzy feeling you get when you read something really good, watch the movie everyone's been talking about, or catch the show the internet can't get over? At the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we chase that feeling 5 times a week. We talk about the buzziest movies, TV, music, books, and more. From lowbrow to highbrow to in between, catch the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Okay, to close things out, let's return to television. The new shows of the spring keep premiering as, you know, the Emmy eligibility window looms. And Beef premieres this week. We mentioned it briefly last week, I think, but reviews are now out. I've seen most of the season, but not all of it. And Rebecca, I know that you were really the first person to kind of tell me to look out for this one. So now that you can talk more freely about it, what should people look for in Beef?
Yeah, I loved Beef. We did a first look, so I saw it pretty early. And then I had no one to talk to about it. And it is definitely one of those shows that I feel like is going to result in a lot of conversation. It's surprising at every turn. And I think the lead performances from both Ali Wong and Steven Yeun are just so strong and just so complicated because these characters do bad things and you still root for them a lot of the time. And it's really sort of messy but so beautifully done. I mean, it goes to some places you will not expect, but I think that's what I loved about it so much is it's just really, really surprising.
They keep doing bad things, which is interesting. You know, there's not like an arc where it's like, and then by episode 6, they've seen the error of their ways and it's about them trying to be better. No, not really. Like it stays pretty dark in a way that's kind of thrilling. And both actors really seem to be very invigorated by that experience, you know. It's really interesting material, really interesting direction. And so is the supporting cast is great. A lot of people I don't think I've seen in things before. And it's just a reminder of, like, when you start to make things about all kinds of people, lo and behold, all these amazing actors emerge who like have been vastly underemployed, you know, in the industry for years, who are capable of great things. And I think this show is a really, you know, mighty testament to that fact.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was doing the first look, they said Steven Yeun was attached very early, even before there were scripts, but they had debated the sort of person that he gets in this road rage incident with to be more of like a Stanley Tucci sort of character. But I think it just adds so much more, I don't know, depth to the story, having it be Ali Wong and sort of where her storyline goes. So it's interesting to see the way it evolved, because it is amazing to see this all Asian cast, but it's not an identity show. It doesn't really, there's a couple jokes about it, but there are parts of their cultural story, you know, like a Korean church, that just feel like such a natural part of the story. So I think it's a really, really special show, and I'm excited for people to discuss it once it comes out.
Rebecca, you've also been talking to Young Mazzino, who plays Steven Yeun's character's brother, who I think really exemplifies that breakout quality you're talking about, Richard.
Oh, you mean when he gets shirtless? he's terrific, you know, and it's really exciting. And I think that, you know, it's something akin in a way to watching Fire Island or Bros, where it's like internal debate and differences of identity within a sort of group, you know, and we don't get to see that enough. Usually there's sort of a token minority character or a token queer character or whatever. And in Beef, it's like, it's just, it's all so in world and, you know, these are very different people who might from a distance be considered, oh, they're Asian, they're the same. And it's like, no, there's a vast complexity of experience and economic reality and all kinds of other things that the show really delves into with a naturalness, because it's, you know, it's made by people who understand what they're talking about.
I also add that Ashley Park is not a breakout for people who watch Emily in Paris, but I was not one of those people. So it's kind of the first time I've seen her in anything, and she's wonderful. And Rebecca, you're working on something for the future, kind of talking about her character as a level of rich, different from the other many levels of rich in this show. And I love the variety and kind of what she brings to that and that character specifically.
I feel like we're going to have a cool Ashley Park year, because I saw Joyride, which was at South By, that she's also in. And she's doing a lot of different stuff, because I think she's a little limited in what she gets to do in Emily in Paris. So I think it's going to be, we're going to hear a lot from her soon, I think.
Yeah. I don't think she makes any jokes about shopping, which is all she does in Emily in Paris, I feel like.
Okay, to circle back to last week's kind of broader Emmy season conversation, which, again, we knew we weren't going to get to everything because it's impossible to, because there's so many shows. But I did want to mention two particular shows that I do think will be relevant this season. And Rebecca, you, I think, since we recorded that, caught up on all of Shrinking. the Big Apple show from Bill Lawrence, it's kind of the, like, Ted Lasso still on, but it's sort of the Ted Lasso of this year because it's new and it's got that similar kind of humor. And I'm still catching up to it, but it sounds like you really enjoyed it.
I did enjoy it. I watched it super fast over like 2 days, but I had off. I was not doing this during work hours. But it has that humor, that some of the humor that you kind of feel with Ted Lasso, that sort of bright, shiny humor. But I really enjoyed Jason Segel in it. I think he, you know, he plays this dad who's he's still sort of struggling with the grief of the loss of his wife, and he's also a shrink and works for Harrison Ford's company, who was also a shrink, and they have a nice little chemistry between the two of them that I really enjoyed. And it's a well done show that's relatively, I think, simple. Like, it's not, as we were just talking about Beef, it's not like full of shocking twists and turns, but I thought it was a really pleasant watch, and I could see it definitely being in the conversation, especially for things like writing and maybe performance. So I definitely would say tune in if you just want a sort of light, enjoyable show.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of people with interesting years, Harrison Ford having that, and then Indiana Jones 5. Like, I don't know what that means Emmy-wise, but it's in 1923. God, he's absolutely
everywhere.
Yeah. And then we had someone else write in that we did not mention The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel at all, which is kind of oversight on our part. It's been such an awards juggernaut. Although I looked up that for its fourth season, it got a ton of nominations and won nothing, which honestly kind of surprised me. It's got such good crafts, like you'd think it'd get in somewhere. But I watched a few episodes of the new season, which is premiering on April 14th, so very shortly. And I do think it's interesting. It's its final season. It kind of knows that it's its final season and is going into it kind of trying to tie up some loose ends, do some things that are new. So I think the eternal question in the Emmys is how much voters care about things being fresh and how much they kind of get tired of something and want to move on to the new thing. Because for so long, the Emmys notoriously didn't do that and give the same award to Frasier for 8 years in a row. But I think as a kind of swan song, you know, this is going to, in its final season, Barry is, Ted Lasso, we think is, it'll be interesting to see how much people want to come back around and throw awards at something one last time.
It is crazy how many shows are ending or supposedly ending this semi season. I don't know what their voters are going to do with that.
It would be nice if Ted Lasso would tell us one way or another so we can stop having to hedge our bets around it. And the screeners for Barry have gone out, so we will be able to start giving a read on that fairly soon. You know, it's inside baseball, but for some shows, you kind of get a look at them ahead of the season, and some other ones that may be currently airing. They're being very stingy with getting us access to it. So for us to get a read on the season as a whole continues to be difficult because there's so much we can't see. That does it for today's show. We'll be back next week. Find us in the meantime at vanityfair.com, on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider, and on our own. I am at Katie Rich, and Richard.
Brian Laws.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best review of your Passover Seder goes to Rebecca Ford.
Yeah, I loved beef.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.